Joe, how you doing?
I'm doing just great, Tim. How are you doing?
Very good. So we're back here, and tonight I wanted you wanted to discuss a piece of yours, Shakespeare's apocalyptic Brave New World and its context. More or less, the Brave New World and the New World Order and the welfare state. But I'm going to let you take the lead on this. How do you want to get into it?
Yeah, it's probably wise because it's such a twisting labyrinth of connections. And, you know, because I've spent a lot of time studying, you know, old books and stuff, I've developed an understanding of this stuff, which few people are even interested in, but I really do think they should pay attention. Shakespeare is, as it turns out, under a little bit of analysis, basically a Jewish literature. I brought out a book called Shakespeare's Secret Messiah. And I show how the plays operate, and basically they're in opposition to Christianity and to the gospel specifically. Even the name Will Shakespeare, which appears in the folio, is a pun within the genre. You know, the idea Will Shakespeare is a martial declaration.
Now, so, do you subscribe to the theory that he's a composite of different people?
Shakespeare?
Yeah, William Shakespeare.
It's a nom de plume.
Yeah.
One individual, I think, wrote almost all of the famous plays. I think some of the histories probably had other authors, and I think Marlowe may have been involved in the histories. But the primary author was a woman named Amelia Bassano, and she was the first woman to ever copyright a work of literature in English language. She wrote a poem called Salve Deus Rex Jordum, which means Hail God, King of the Jews. And I show in the book that that poem has a definite system of puns and connections into Shakespeare's sonnets, which show that Bassano, you know, in fact, wrote both the sonnets and as well as Salve Deus. So I wrote the book explaining how, you know, the plays operate, that they are they're basically mockeries of who they felt produced the Gospels, which is Rome, the Caesars. The group that produced the Shakespearean literature. And Bassano did have quite a bit of help. I mean, she was involved with a whole collection of authors. And so they had this understanding of Christianity, which they are basically mocking with the Shakespearean literature, which is basically a reversal of the humor that they saw in the Gospels. So this is kind of a long piece of analysis for someone who isn't familiar with, like, my book Caesar's Messiah and Shakespeare's Secret Messiah. But the play The Tempest, which is what contains the expression Brave New World, and Brave New World is very important because it's used in a very important way by Rudyard Kipling, a way that foresees a lot of the modern world. That doesn't get a lot of publicity, but I'll talk about it a little bit later. But the novel by Aldous Huxley is entitled Brave New World. And both Kipling and Huxley were aware of the occulted meaning that Shakespeare had for the term. The term just means a world where the Gentiles have been enchanted. They've been put to sleep, basically, through art and other kinds of enchanting mental apparatus, and they no longer really have any power. And what is interesting is that this is actually the position that the foundation literature of the Shakespearean play has. And this is something that, you know, if you go to my article on The Tempest, the Brave New World article, which is available at Post Flavia and org or at caesarsmessiah.com. You can go to either one of those sites and get the, you can see the article. It's not, there's no charge. It's a free article. You can read it. But anyway, I show that, and this is something that, that a lot of Shakespearean scholars had understood, is that the play The Tempest is based upon Isaiah. And most, in fact, that's just clear. All Shakespearean scholars are aware of that fact, that the expression The Tempest, the character Ariel, and the three individuals that are the drunkenness that occurs are all things from Isaiah. And what I show is in the analysis is that The Tempest is not just containing those elements. And incidentally, the expression Ariel is very important for people to understand, because it means basically the spirit of Jerusalem or the Jewish people. I mean, it's a synonym for Israel as a, you know, description of the Jewish people. And so in Isaiah, Ariel, you know, is is beaten and there's attacks against Jerusalem. But Ariel always manages to stay in existence. And then as you go forward in Isaiah, you know, he basically talks about an apocalypse of the Gentile. And he talks about how it will be as though they thought they were eating and they woke up from a dream hungry. You know, the idea of a dream that they have been placed into that's just so complete that they won't understand what is real and what isn't. So what I do in the analysis on The Tempest is I show that it isn't just the beginning of Isaiah 24 through, you know, like Isaiah 31, which has, you know, the character Ariel and these other elements. It has, it describes the tempest, the storm, you know, that the play begins with. But in fact, there are very subtle symbolic connections inside the play that link further to Isaiah. Because when Isaiah gets into Isaiah 33, 34, 35, you get into this apocalypse of the Gentile. And that's really what the point of the play is. And that's really what the brave new world that Shakespeare is talking about is depicting. Now, the one thing to remember is that in the Shakespearean era, the term brave didn't mean simply courage, but also flamboyance, or in a fashion sense, kind of dazzling. And that's really the correct understanding of how the word is being used. It just relates to the conclusion of The Tempest, where Prospero stands in front of the audience by himself and he says, you know, I need your help. I need the audience of the theatrical performance to cooperate. Otherwise, my project's going to fail. And he talks about needing art to enchant. And that's the bravery of the brave new world. It is just the enchanted world. Think of the enchanted kingdom, Disneyland. Right?
Or the American dream.
Or the American dream, brother. You got it. It's exactly right. Yeah. So that's what's going on in both Isaiah and then Shakespeare picks it up and just makes a whole little story out of the thing. But you know, one thing that's very important is that the perspective of the author is not of a Gentile. No way. A Gentile wouldn't pick up and make a whole, you know, story out of Isaiah 29 through 35. It's the most anti-Gentile passage imaginable, right? It's all, you know, destruction of the Gentile. So that is the basis of the term, and then it gets reused. Huxley uses it, but before Huxley, Tim, it gets used by Rudyard Kipling, the insane Freemason. If you ever look at photographs of Kipling, some of my favorite photographs are, he has like these black pajamas that have Freemason symbols like moons and stars and all-seeing eyes, and they're all embroidered into it. And he's dancing around like he's some kind of nymph. He's spinning around and dancing, you know, and it's just, I mean, he's just a complete whack job. He wrote this poem, which is, just the gods of the copybook headings. Okay, so, you know, and the god of the copybook headings, he's just talking about how, you know, man goes through time and becomes, you know, more sophisticated. And then he, at the end, he uses the expression, but he also, you know, he talks about they denied that wishes were horses. They denied that a pig had wings. So the pig with wings, I mean, this gets reused in our modern culture a lot. It comes from here, and it's just, he's using pig as a synonym for Gentiles, which the Shakespearean literature does, and that's why he uses the expression here. And wishes were horses. Remember, Richard III, a horse, my kingdom for a horse. I mean, see, this is, they're mocking the horses of the apocalypse in the book of Revelation, right? It's a little cryptic. I don't want to spend too much time, but because I want to get into the conclusion of the of this stuff, because also there's another poem I want to get into too. But anyway, so Kipling's poem is kind of nuts. It's on its surface, you know, it seems crazy, very violent. You know, he says that there are only four things certain since social progress began: that the dog returns to its vomit, and the sow returns to her mire, and the burnt fool's bandaged finger goes wobbling back to the fire. Right? These people just can't get away from their nature, which is so debased. And then he goes, and that after this is accomplished, and the brave new world begins, where all men are paid for existing and no man must pay for his sins, as surely as water will wet us, as surely as fire will burn, the gods of the copybook headings with terror and slaughter return. There's a sunny vision of the world from this whack job Freemason. But it's an important thing because, you know, this is written like I think around 1900, and he talks about social progress and when men are paid for existing and no man must pay for sins. So he's talking about the welfare state.
Yeah, this is the dawn of the progressive era. Yeah.
Exactly right, right. But here you can see the Masonic, you know, understanding of what it is. It's a way basically to make the population impotent, slaves of the state, because, you know, the brave new world begins and men are paid for existing. Very clear, right? It's hardly even cryptic at all. You know, this is what we get. We're going to get Social Security, the welfare state, the social progress movement, but doesn't look too good for the Europeans because the gods of the copybook heading. Now, the copybook heading gods are just basically sayings from the Old Testament that used to be in the top of the school books that British school kids would have, right? So when he's talking about the gods of the copybook headings, he's just basically talking about, Old Testament slaughter and terror. And I mean, obviously it is the Old Testament because the New Testament God, you know, is not seen as coming back with terror and slaughter. Well, actually, perhaps that's not true because you get it, the apocalypse. But in general, this is more relating to Old Testament. And so what Kipling is clearly saying is that the plan is to create a welfare state. And this would be basically the dog returning to his vomit, and the sow returning to her mire, and the burnt fool's bandage goes wobbling back to the fire. And after this is accomplished, and the brave new world begins. See, you know, they're related. When all men are paid for existing. So anyway, Kipling's vision of the welfare state is very important because of his very concrete connections into Masonry. And I'll give you a little heads up about Kipling. He used to spend the summers for a number of years vacationing with his two closest friends, Cecil Rhodes and the Baron Rothschild.
Well, you'd be a fly on the wall in that conversation.
Yeah, that would have been fun. When Rothschild died, they read Kipling's poems, you know, at the funeral. The gardener, which I won't decode, but I do understand, and it's just nuts. But anyway, so there's actually, written documents indicating that during the Boer Wars, these three were in control of the Masonic British forces. They were known to have been together and would meet in private. No one could hear their conversation while they were talking as the information was coming in about what was going on with the Boers. So, Kipling's very, very important, not as a poet, because he is just one of the most crap poets imaginable, but because of his political structure and, into history and things. So then this brings us to a real mystery. Hey, I got a mystery here for you, buddy. Guess what? So there's a secret Kipling poem. I'm going to read a letter from Winston Churchill to FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And a short little letter. I won't bore you. So it goes, Dear Mr. President, I'm writing to send you this letter. I'm sending you this letter, two small unpublished works of Rudyard Kipling, which I think I mentioned to you. Similar copies were given recently by the president of the Royal College of Surgeons of England on the occasion of my admission as an honorary fellow of the college, and I thought you would like to have both books for your library. I understand that Mrs. Kipling decided not to publish them in case they led to controversy, and is therefore important that their existence should not become known, and there should be no public references to this gift. Yours sincerely, Winston Churchill. Oh, my God. What would these Masonic buddies not want to have the public to be aware of about a poem from Rudyard Kipling, who is such a big-time guy? Hard to understand, isn't it? Well, here's the poem. It's entitled Burden of Jerusalem. And I'm not going to read the whole poem. It's just too long. But it's available online. And it starts out with the description of Sarah, the daughter of Abraham, slapping the Gentile. And it's Genesis 16:6. And so it's the, Abraham said to Sarah, behold, thy maid is in thy hand. Do to her as it pleaseth thee. And when Sarah dealt hardly with her, slaps her, she fled from her face. So that's like a very charming beginning of a poem. Wouldn't you say, Tim? Nice Old Testament uplifting passage. Gets you in the mood for a little poetry, doesn't it? So the poem begins, it goes, in ancient days in deserts wild, there rose a feud still unsubdued twixt Sarah's child and Hagar's child. That would be your Jews and Gentiles. Hagar is, seen as Arabia, but is also, just a general term for Gentile. So there's a feud still unsubdued, that centered around Jerusalem. So then he goes on to this long thing about all of these battles that happened around Jerusalem. And, he talks about Titus. He says, angry Titus overthrew the fabric of Jerusalem. Muhammad came, and it says, and every realm they wandered through rose far or near in hate or fear and robbed and tortured, chased and slew the outcasts of Jerusalem. So he's talking about the Jews. Right. He's very positive. He goes, so you've had this real terrible history of what goes on in Jerusalem and happens to the Jews. And so then he goes, and every realm they wandered through rose far near in hate or fear and robbed and tortured, chased and slew the outcasts of Jerusalem. That's talking about the diaspora. So ran their doom, half seer, half slave, in ages past. And at the last, they stood beside each tyrant's grave and whispered of Jerusalem. He's talking about the love and longing for the diaspora and Jews to return. We do not know what God attends the of loved race in every place where they amass their dividends from Riga to Jerusalem. But all the course of times makes clear to everyone except the Hun, it does not pay to interfere with Cohen from Jerusalem. Now here's just off the rails here. He goes, for beneath the rabbi's curls and fur are saints and movie kings. The aloof, unleavened blood of yore brewed steadfast on Jerusalem. I'll just read it again. For neath the rabbi's curls and fur are scents and rings of movie kings. And see, this is like, critical. It's giving you Kipling, early 20th century description of movie kings being part of the aloof, unleavened blood of the diaspora, mm-hmm. right? Doesn't make you feel too good about the movie industry, does it, when you hear this? Yeah. Pretty. Beneath the rabbi's curls and fur are saints and rings of movie king, the aloof, unleavened blood of your brood steadfast on Jerusalem. So anyway, it goes, and burdened Gentiles over the main must bear the weight of Israel hate, because he is not brought again in triumph to Jerusalem. Okay, one more time. And burdened Gentiles over the main must bear the weight of Israel's hate, because he is not brought again in triumph to Jerusalem. So Kipling's position is that the movie kings are part of this hatred, right? Mm-hmm. You must bear the weight of Israel's hate, the movie kings. And so big ending here. He goes, yet he who bred the unending strife was not brave enough to save the bonds made from the furious wife. Now, he's talking about the beginning of the poem where the maids get slapped about by Sarah who runs away. So he who bred the unending strife, okay, that would be the Gentiles, was not brave enough to save the bonds made from the furious wife. He wrought thy woe, Jerusalem. Right. So this is the poem. My understanding of it, I can assure you, is clear-minded. I'm familiar with Kipling's stuff, and I know the symbolism here, and I can just assure you that it's just exactly as it is on the surface narration. He's just talking about, a kind of hatred that is justified in violence. You see, this is, we've talked about the moral authority involved in the counterculture right away. Who would have that? Well, Kipling would be someone who would have something like that, because he is referencing to this passage in the Old Testament, which is, this is a slave, right, who pisses off Sarah, and Abraham says, just do whatever you want to her, and she slaps her around. And this is supposed to be, like basically as the Old Testament is structured, God's will, right? This is good. This is order out of chaos, right? So now when you get here and you read that, beneath the rabbi's curls and fur are scents and kings of movie kings, see? This doesn't look too good, Tim. I mean, this looks pretty organized and full of a lot of hatred, wouldn't you say?
pretty malevolent. Yes.
Pretty malevolent. Yeah. And then now here's my question. Okay. What does the Freemason Winston Churchill see that is positive about the poem that he would send it on to Roosevelt? Who then, and incidentally, responds by saying, oh, yes, I'm aware of it. Now, this is very important. Roosevelt wrote back to Churchill. Roosevelt says, oh, I'm aware of it. I got this poem. And it's a beauty. It's a gem, right? Really? What is gem-like? He used the expression gem. What is gem-like about the burden of Jerusalem, which is so violent and racist?
Yeah, what's beautiful about it? About slaughter.
What's beautiful about, it seems to me it's like talking about a secret plot against the Gentiles and just hatred everywhere and violence being condoned. I don't see anything here that is a gem, you see. But that this is the letter. The letter I wrote is on the Churchill's, this is, believe me, the stuff I'm showing you is absolutely documented. There's no question. This is all real exchange between Churchill and Roosevelt. Roosevelt's statement about keeping it quiet, that Kipling's wife didn't want it to be published. Well, that makes perfect sense, right? I can understand that. But what I don't understand is why these two world leaders would have, taken this position. This seems a little bit suspicious to me.
What's the date of the letter?
The letter's date is October 17th, 1943.
Okay, so the middle of the war.
Right in the middle of the war.
Yeah. It's interesting. Of course, we all know one of the... in the aftermath of the war, you had the birth of the State of Israel as a consequence of the war and the reported atrocities that were committed against the Jews in Europe. And also the big part that the British Empire played in midwifing the Israeli state, with the Balfour Declaration and the intrigues it involved and the promises that influential Jewish financiers in Great Britain could draw the United States into the war through their connections with the Woodrow Wilson administration, like Bernard Baruch and who's the other guy up in New York? Samuel Untermyer, these guys who had...
Untermyer, right. Well, that's the Schofield Bible guy.
Yeah, another thing is they sponsored the production of the Schofield Bible after the Pope said no to Israel.
Yeah, it's a crazy translation, and it's just all about promoting the State of Israel. I mean, it's crazy. It's absolutely amazing that thing ever got, the light of day.
And the Schofield Bible birthed the Christian Zionism, which is so cute. Yeah. That's how the very small Jewish population, and also the much, much smaller Jewish elite who control the Zionist agenda, are able to bring in the ranks of millions and millions of Christian Zionists into their fold.
Right, and it's really interesting. I'll tell you something just fascinating, is that there was a guy who had influence on Schofield, and I'm going to blank on the names. I think it was like Raglan or something. But he was part of the Theosophical Society, mm-hmm. right? And so there at the bottom of this whole, chain of events, you've got basically Aleister Crowley, because the woman who I'm also drawing a blank on, what's her name? He was the founder of it.
Bassan?
She is not Bassan. There's someone else. Who is really more the founder. I'm sorry. Gosh darn it. She really kind of was the founder of the Theosophical Society, but she was from Crowley.
Yes.
She was one of Crowley's, proteges. Now, what is absolutely fascinating to me is that so not only does Christian Zionism in a way have one of the strands that leads to its origin, the Theosophical Society, because Schofield comes out of that world, but this woman, and it's some bizarre Ukrainian name that, she's just this horrid looking witch-like creature. I can't remember her name. I'm getting old. But she was really the founder of the Thule Society. Now, have you ever heard of that?
Oh yeah, they very influential in the rise of National Socialism. At least
well, it was. It actually is the Nazi Party, because the organization which had an acronym of like PCR or something. It was Workers Party. It comes directly from Thule Society. It was actually like a kind of a sub. Part of the organization, but then changes its name to the Nazi.
Yeah, it was Helen Blavatsky.
That's and so anyway,
Helen Blavatsky. Yeah,
Helen. So the Thule Society is the major strand to produce the Nazis. I mean, literally, if you trace this back and actually look at the letters and how the thing is structured, it goes right back to the Thule Society. But on the other side of the ocean, it's. The same individual, and Crowley is right at the bottom of them, you're getting the Schofield Bible. And so I mean, it's just going to require an explanation, would you say?
Well, yeah, it's again, we're going back to a British, and Chris, with Crowley, you get into British intelligence, and he was an asset of British intelligence during the First World War here in the United States. Writing
Yeah,
pro-German, writing pro-German literature, by the way.
I know.
So it gets real twisted.
His last name, I don't want that to nitpick, but his last name is Crowley,
That's right,
like the
yeah.
bird,
Yeah, Crowley
or
is
rhymed
how
with holy.
that's right, Crowley is how
I know, so I've been saying, I said it Crowley for years and years, and people just corrected me for
it's
so
Crowley.
long.
It's Crowley, yeah.
I finally got it. And because, and they, and it's because I've seen some of his poetry, and he rhymes his last name with holy,
Yeah, I think
so
Ozzy Osbourne pronounced it
there you go.
Crowley or something. That's what he'll get Crowley, or that's what he'll get confused by.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's
So
yeah,
anyway,
that's.
Brave New World. So now Aldous Huxley comes along, and we can really see the Shakespearean plot, right, in motion, because, well, first of all, Huxley uses Shakespearean quotes about, I don't know, like 30 times in the book. He has the work of Shakespeare as kind of the secret literature, which is inside, and what he does is he make the book Brave New World, and one of the reasons it's kind of on my mind is because it's sort of the centerpiece of the new book, which will be coming out here pretty quick, called The Secret Language of the Oligarchs. And so there I show that the Brave New World is just this big Masonic nightmare. It's a little better literature, but it's the same kind of stuff that I show in Catcher in the Rye, if you've ever seen that analysis, that there's just cryptic Freemason references throughout the entire thing. And in this case, the Shakespearean literature is hidden in a lodge, right? And it's a secret book, and they bring it out, and then they give it to the blonde-haired guy as just a way to make him feel terrible. But the thing about how Huxley is a Brave New World doesn't really require any kind of like literary analysis. It's actually a historical fact is that Huxley on YouTube, you can see this. He has this long interview with Mike Wallace, and there he just goes on and on about how dangerous it is that the government might get ways to control our minds with drugs and these fancy psychological techniques. I mean, you listen to the interview, Huxley just sits there and stares right into the camera and goes on for a bloody hour about how dangerous it is and how we've got to all be worried about it. But at the exact same time, there are letters that have come into existence which show that he was organizing projects in MK Ultra, right? So in other words, it is an absolute fingerprint of the secret society. This is something you can no conjecture is required. Huxley is lying, and he's providing some plausible deniability for himself, and he's also basically kind of confusing things. But the facts are the letter exists that he tells Humphrey Osmond to go down and get Jolly West to do a particular experiment. And Jolly West, because we got the MK Ultra pay requisitions, we know where he was and what hospitals he was operating at and what sub projects of MK Ultra he was doing. So we know that Huxley is actually basically giving instructions to an MK Ultra doctor about experiments that are going to be part of the MK Ultra science that the government is then going to use against the population. And so this is really easy to understand. You don't need then to look at Brave New World in the occulted way. I get deep into the weeds and plant as with a lot of the symbol stuff. Because people have the right framework, they just don't have a clue as to what it means. And it's a very nasty piece of business. It's very much like Kipling's poem, The Burden of Jerusalem. It has kind of the exact same perspective. They're reveling in the idea that the Gentile gets crushed. And I think this is really, you're looking at the real secret of Freemasonry, frankly, when you look at these things. So anyway, Huxley talks about a world which is basically genetically stratified and also stratified by psychological technique, chemicals, right? With drugs being you know, the thing. And so this is what the Brave New World is. It is the dumbing down of everyone who isn't in the elite chosen group into structures, and no one can rebel because basically your will has been taken away from you by the conditioning. So when you see for example, the peace movement, right? The hippie stuff. I mean, this is all a way to demasculinize, to take away the authoritarian personality, to use an expression, from the population. So we're looking at our whole culture basically is a weapon, and it's been polluted. You know, it damages us. It's toxic to just our natural health, right?
It betrays, or at least reveals, a very sophisticated understanding of human psychology, and also the difference between the sexes and the respective psychologies of the sexes, because you have to emasculate, you have to destroy male authority to enslave society, because if there's any resistance to tyranny, it usually comes from men who have families to protect, communities to protect, and women by nature, by the whole thing with nesting and children, they tend towards it may offend somebody, they tend towards collaboration. They go with the winners. So if you sort of emasculate the men in that community and leave it to the women, it's much easier to conquer, because by nature they will tend to collaborate and go along with the agenda. Well, I think we see that roughly played out in today's politics with the feminization of politics and the welfare state and these things. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. I mean, just look at the morphology, the differences in body structures. Who's designed for fighting? You know, the male. So if you're going to have a rebellion, you better believe the males are going to be the ones, you know, basically leading it. That's just kind of a historical, in terms of evolution, fact. Mm-hmm. So if you can move the males a nudge over toward feminism or femininity, then you've gone a long way to, you know, establishing a permanent slave state.
Yeah, the metrosexual, the latter-day dandy. has no progeny to care for, no sense of posterity. He's cut off from his ethnic religious roots. He's a metrosexual cosmopolitan.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, if you look at the authoritarian personality science, right, just look at it as a science. Look at all the scales. The metrosexual would be the finished product. I mean, he would not have an authoritarian personality. He would not have, he would not be ethnocentric. He would not be anti-Semitic. He just wouldn't be in any way, masculine. And so that was the idea. And certainly, you know, you can see it just everywhere today. I mean, Bruce Jenner would be sort of the role model or the avant-garde for the new culture that they're bringing about.
Yeah, I mean, that story is just so strange and so in your face. The fact that people just accept that as just a independent, organic news story. Obviously, he's an experiment. The decathlon, the alpha male decathlon winner to this bizarre looking creature who, if you get a good, he doesn't even look like a woman, looks like a man dressed as a woman. I'm sorry, that's what he is. Nothing more, nothing less.
It's just that obviously it's a psychological device to just confuse masculinity in males' mind. That's what it is. There is plasticity. Obviously, there have been cultures that are not suffering from conditioning from malevolent force that have had large fractions of homosexuality, but I don't think it was the effeminate kind of. In other words, if you look at the Greeks,
very different,
the Romans, it's very different cultural phenomena, and I don't think it affected their personalities. The gay personality that television has given us since, the 1960s is very feminized.
Yeah, the narcissist.
Yeah, and very narcissistic. And so that I don't think you're going to find often in Roman generals and things like this. So it was just
Sparta. You won't find that. You won't find Will and Grace in Sparta.
Right. I mean, right, exactly. It's just not going to happen. And so we had a different kind of situation, but they realized that, and so they decided they would try to promote it, and just again they would weaponize it. And the weaponization of it was to create the feminine homosexual. Well, that's my opinion.
You get into it, of course, in that poem he talks about people being who paid to live, and that you're saying that's sort of a anticipating or underrating the welfare state. And the welfare state, the welfare state puts us under the boot of the drill sergeant, and of course the welfare state we're enslaved to the nursemaid. Either way, we're under control. It's the warfare state. And it's interesting because the welfare state largely was birthed from the warfare state. He's here in the United States with the army, with pensions and things like that. That's how it kind of came out of. And also a lot of the legislation that the New Deal relied upon dates back to the First World War, Trading with the Enemy Act and things like that. These are legislation that the FDR administration used to justify the seizure of gold in 1934. The idea that this welfare state can be used to, it's fairly obvious how it can be used to, expand government control of our lives, because whoever pays the piper curls the tune, and if they're paying for our survival, they're going to tell us how to live. But in the 19... look at the progressive legislation. Of course, we had this Federal Reserve Act was a progressive piece of legislation, if you can believe it. It was, but the whole progressive era was the whole myth of this sort of modernization, rationalization of government under the guise of sort of the rule of the experts, technocracy or scientism. And this was being set up by the oligarchs because they were going to put in place these technicians, these technocrats, these academicians and these bureaucrats that they would do their bidding. They would get control of the bureaucracies, whether it's the FDA or the Federal Reserve Board or the Federal Trade Commission, these things. Once you create these power centers, it's just a question of subordinating those power centers. So it was a strategy.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah.
But, of course, when they passed the Federal Reserve Act, I think it was Charles Lindbergh's father who said, well, now booms and busts will be scientifically engineered.
Exactly right. The thing is that the Federal Reserve system and the whole transfer of control of production of money from the Congress to the bankers that owned the Federal Reserve Corporation was, I think, the most clever and subtle form of enslavement that we're suffering from.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, basically, what they were able to do is to, it's just like when Kipling says, all men are paid for existing. Well, the reason why men are paid for existing is because no one has a job. And the reason why there's no jobs is because the wealth has been sucked out of the economy, and therefore its self-reliance is almost impossible to achieve, because there's no place for wealth to exist. And what they've done is they can debase the currency faster than there is wage growth. So you think that, gee, I'm getting ahead. My wages have doubled. But the problem is that the currency is only worth a quarter of what it was. I mean, think of where the currency was relative to gold, say in 1917, right?
Oh, yeah.
And where it is now. I mean, that's just that's one of the reasons why gold has been massively suppressed. They control the price by short selling it for this huge dumping of the market. But
they call it paper gold.
Right, paper gold. Yeah, but But the thing is that even with that, you know, gold is $1,200, whereas it was like $30 back then. Well, that's what you're seeing is the debasement of the dollar when you look at the price of gold. Gold just is static. The dollar has simply gone way, way down in purchasing price. And that's just a complete result of the activity of the Federal Reserve. They have debased the currency. Now, this is happening faster than you have wage growth. Because for one thing, with the currency debasing, it's harder for businesses to make true profits. So the fact is that now, even though everyone is making hundreds of thousands of dollars a year, you have to have both parents in the workplace. And they rent their homes, they don't either own them. I mean, where I live in Santa Barbara, a couple cannot come here unless you're very, very wealthy and just buy even like a middle class home. Mm-hmm. And that would be like $1,200,000. You'd have to have, you know, $400,000 or $500,000 in saved money, right? Imagine now, where is a couple at 30 with two kids going to come up with that kind of savings?
Yeah, and they're the true source of wealth of society because they're having children.
Of course. And so we're just
not the paper money,
Yeah, we're just upside down because the Federal Reserve is just this very subtle kind of slavery that no one sees or understands or talks about, but is going on every single day because they can subtract from our wealth with their debasement of the currency. And it's a twofer for them. They take the money and, you know, while they're debasing the currency, all the money they create, they spend on wars, right, and technology of enslavement. And then our currency is worth less, so we're more easy to enslave. So you get the picture. We're just headed in the wrong direction in every possible way.
Yeah, and of course, the existence of a central bank and, of course, with a currency that's not tied to anything of value like gold, which might impose some discipline on the creation of money, just leads you to this astronomical, you know, debt, which is just perpetual debt enslavement. But if you look at the post-war fiscal policy in the United States, have became just so reckless, and a lot of people just ascribe that to politics, the growth of the welfare state, sort of just a convergence of events that occurred after the war. But I suggest that there's probably something more malevolent, more planned involved here. You know, judging from the poem,
Kidding. Poem is a really good marker.
Yeah, because
shows people what's good. And this was written in 1915, 1920, something like that.
Yeah, because in the middle of in the 60s, we have this great society that's unfurled by Lyndon Baines Johnson, and this explosion of welfare spending that occurred. Although the poverty rate had been declining an average about a point a year from 1948 to 1963,
boom.
But also we have this crisis of poverty in the country because some people are poor, or at least thought to be poor by the standards of, I guess, of the intellectuals at the time. But this supposedly necessitated this massive government intervention, massive government spending, which is massive borrowing, because also at the same time they're fighting the Vietnam War and other things. But in 1966, there's this two sociologists out of Columbia University, surprise, surprise, Clarid and Piven. It's called the Clarid-Piven strategy. It was outlined in 1966, and it was basically called for the intentional overloading of the U.S. public welfare system in order to precipitate a crisis that would lead to the replacement of the welfare system with a national system of guaranteed national income and widespread socialism. So when you look at, you know, all this talk about balance the budget and trying to get spending under control and these things, there's no intention to do that, because one thing is all this debt, the bankers make tons of money just off the interest payments. But the same thing is there's been an intentional plan to overload the very system, to precipitate a crisis, to bring about something, that talk about Freemasonic.
I know. Out of chaos order. Well, first we need the chaos. So they create the chaos, and they're ready with the order, you know. So
yeah, but
that's
it was an excuse to abandon the U.S. Constitution, because what they saw as limiting. Of course, I mean, the government had long since done that. I think when they justified, I think it was in the 30s, when the switch in time that saved nine, when FDR threatened to pack the court because the Supreme Court was declaring some of his New Deal initiatives unconstitutional, like the National Industrial Recovery Act and the Agriculture Adjustment Act. But all in the last minute, they switch, and all of a sudden they declare the work, I think it was the Wagner Act, the National Labor Relations Act, and also the Social Security Act. I think it was Helfering v. Davis. It was suddenly constitutional. And then in the 60s, you had the amendments to Social Security was, of course, this huge Medicare program, middle-class welfare for middle-class elderly people. And I think there was a study, the projected cost of Medicare, by 1990, it was seven times what they projected. Seven times
right.
that they projected. Oops. You know?
Yeah.
So
yeah, these are real specialists and experts. They're only off 700%.
So much for the technocrats and experts, right?
yeah, they're doing a great job. Let's go with them.
But the libertarian critique, which I'm very supportive of, generally speaking, tends to write it off as just bad policy, bad political philosophy. Nothing really malevolent, no intention. But I with Cloud Piven and sort of this. Idea of using the welfare state to lead to man slaughter, I think you'd agree with me that there's something much more malevolent here.
Well, can I just read a relevant passage?
Sure.
And that after this is accomplished and the brave new world begins, when all men are paid for existing and no man must pay for his sins. Notice that no man must pay for his sins.
Yeah.
That just seems like Hollywood, right? The debauched, kind of moral cult. No man must pay for his sins. But as surely as water will wet us, as surely as fire will burn, the gods of the copybook headings with terror and slaughter return.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the vision of the future is not too good here. Tim, it seems to me that the gods of the copybook heading are going to come back with terror and slaughter. I don't know, but that sort of suggests that at the end of the program that has been set up, right, with men are being paid for existing and nobody has to pay for their sins, that there's a plan, that there is a plan. And it doesn't look good because it looks like the gods of the copybook headings, which I know are the, this is the Old Testament, right? This is where the copybook headings come from. The moral, remember, this is not, Athens, democracy and beauty gods. I mean, this is the Ten Commandment, Yahweh Old Testament God, the gods of the copybook heading. With terror and slaughter return. So I think people should pay attention to people like Kipling because, he's really embroiled inside the political world and the financial world with the people he knows. He's not just some little desk clerk in India writing some weird poetry. I mean, this guy is a major player inside the real world.
Yeah,
he certainly is a Mason. And so
he's like H.G. Wells.
Yeah.
You have to, H.G. Wells science
much, yeah,
fiction
exactly.
becomes reality.
Yeah. Exactly. See, so and here I'm just so this is because you see inside the Masonic high level, they actually know this stuff. You see? This is what you're getting. It's written in a poem, so their position is the population is too stupid to understand anything. I mean, that's basically what this is about. That's why with the burden of Jerusalem, Churchill told Roosevelt to keep it quiet because it's just too damn obvious what it means, right?
Yeah.
That's what he was saying, dude, that's just too obvious. We better keep this quiet because we don't want to expose Kipling. And because if Kipling's exposed and people read, well, gee, the gods of the copybook headings are coming back with terror and slaughter, this doesn't look too good. This looks like a group is in control here. Roosevelt and Churchill are involved. Kipling, who is Rothschild's vacation mate, is involved. And they have an understanding, you see, that we don't. You see, that's one thing that's just completely clear from the letter. Is that Roosevelt and Churchill have an understanding of literature that the common person does not have,
mm-hmm.
right? and isn't supposed to have, because they very, very subtly talk about, well, let's just not let anybody see this one.
Yeah, yeah.
And so there it is. You know, it's important stuff, and it's this is all in the new book, The Secret Language of the Oligarchs. I mean, what I try to do with the book is just to, you know, basically put this stuff into, you know, kind of decode the symbolism and then just put it into historical context. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not hard to understand this stuff if you know what Kipling's background is and who his social connections, and you understand, you know, MK Ultra and who these connections are. You know, it just becomes, I think, you get to see a really clear organizational structure of power, and it's one that has genocide in mind. You know, yeah. Aaron Slaughter's coming back. If we don't do something about it, it's gonna, it's coming our way.
Well, it's what you stand back and look at the bigger picture, and what you really see is a pattern of what the oligarchs do. What the secret society does is it precipitates a crisis,
yeah,
and then stands as the solution. You know. Power, it's the old, crisis, you know, what's that, reaction solution? What's
never
that?
Waste a crisis?
Yeah, never waste a crisis. It's problem, reaction, solution.
Yeah, problem, reaction.
Even Andrew Pike wrote Pike wrote about this.
Yeah.
By doing this. But through, central banking, through these government institutions, they can engineer crises. They can collapse, strategically collapse currencies, cause currency crisis in certain countries, buy up things on the cheap, pump and dump on these things.
Yeah.
Now, what you see is one other piece of documents, very important, I think it sheds a lot of light on this, is we have the crises of the 20th century, the Great Depression, the wars. These things are precipitated. We didn't trip into these things. The leader, it wasn't stupidity, it was malevolence that led to these things. But in 1974, which is interesting, it's an interesting date because it's like 10 years, almost 10 years after Kennedy was assassinated, and you have the tumult of the 60s. You had this thing out of Standard Research Institute, the Changing Images of Man, which says things are unsustainable. Because they're unsustainable, we have to change human nature and engage in this widespread psychological warfare, changing how we look at the world, how we look at each other, how men and women look at each other. And it's because everything is unsustainable. But they're the ones that made it unsustainable.
Yeah. Well, so, I mean, Willis Herrmann, I mean, this is all just MK Ultra stuff. These guys are MK Ultra, just everywhere inside these organizations. Mm-hmm. And then, the Stanford Research Institute and the Palo Alto VA, where you've got, the Grateful Dead hanging out. I mean, it's just a cesspool of, Masonic and different secret societies all interacting in between the little MKUltra funding sources. And Herrmann is there talking about how we've got to have this mass scale psychological change, right? The changing image of man. Well, Tim, doesn't that just plug right into the conclusion of the authoritarian personality?
Yes. Yeah. Exactly.
You know, where they talk about you got to have a mass scale psychological, where you use Eros as the, as the tool to start bringing change about.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and what's used, Hollywood, the magic, the black magic kingdom, Hollywood.
Yeah,
it's all
black,
used in there. Again, when we talk about welfare, what the welfare state does is it addresses. A lot through the 30s and the 60s, you had all these this legislation passed. You had minimum wage laws, National Labor Relations Act, things. You have collective bargaining, the strengthening of unions, and then you had, in the 60s, you had the civil rights legislation, the housing laws, you had welfare, you had aid for families with dependent children. Then that was finally ended in the 90s with the state program, the SNAP program, food stamp program. These are supposedly remedies to the capitalism's inequities or the greed of capitalism, the problems with the capitalist system, the exploitative nature of capitalism. But one thing is these liberals that supposedly love the poor never go after things like the Federal Reserve and monetary debasement and usury. which is at the core of the exploitative system. These things don't address that. These things are, I mean, they just make it worse because they borrow money from the banks to pay for the programs.
That's such a good point. I mean, the thing is that with the SNAP cards, right, the people are at a level of poverty that basically they're like one government handout away from starvation.
Yeah.
This wasn't where the poor were, even in the 20s. There were much larger extended families and ethnic components. You know, they have the pictures of the soup lines. I'm telling you, I've seen the data. The people were far wealthier. And, of course, remember, you had a tremendous fraction of the population that were farmers.
Yeah, they're,
that
yeah,
made their
exactly.
own food.
Yeah, so they're outside the money economy.
They're outside of it. They don't care. They make their food. They exchange it for goods and services. Yeah, the Federal Reserve System is expertly designed to extract wealth from the public, and it has.
Oh,
and it has.
Look,
and that's
talk
why
about,
it's
You know, with Obamacare, which is set up to fail so they could bring in a single-payer system and say, look, it failed. The market failed. And no, when they talk about the problem with healthcare, no one addresses things like, well, I don't know, like the cartelized medical industrial complex. And the fact that, and how the insurance system drives up costs, the third-party reimbursement system, and how the whole nature of medicine, what it really means to get health care, should be a matter of debate, not controlled by a single cartel. You know, the pill pushers in white coats that work for Big Pharma and Big Oil.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's just, it is so sad, Tim, but we are really in a malevolent cesspool because it's almost like you can't even talk about, we talk about sports. Mm-hmm. You know, and it disintegrates into Masonic evil. We talk about, you know, Hollywood, obviously, that's just a complete cesspool in our entertainment industry. But then you talk about the medical, and it is just sick, to use an expression. You know, I won't go to doctors anymore. I've studied it for years, and I've just come to the conclusion that while I'm sure they're, well, I mean, it's not true. If it's a mechanical problem like a broken bone or
trauma surgery or something,
I will take care of that. You know, even like knee replacements, I don't have one, but I know someone who had it. He's very happy with it. But beyond that, the chemicals, the radiation, the chemotherapy, forget about it. I would not a chance. They don't have a drug out there that I want to have put in my body. So I just don't trust them. And you know, just as a little, you know, for what it's worth, I mean, I try to eat absolutely chemical free. You know, I mean, I'll pay the extra money to get organic food just because I just don't trust any single thing that they put in the food. I think actually when you look at our food, what you're looking at, you know, in the supermarkets is you're looking at part of the Brave New World. I think that the toxicity in the food is part of what makes people stupid and weak and that's why it's there. It's just one of the ways that they're slowly structuring us, you know, to dumb down. And on their end, they're probably figuring out little clever ways to have some genetic advantages in terms of intelligence. They're trying to make distances as large as possible so that when the gods return with, violence and terror, they're going to be in complete control. You don't have to worry about anyone causing any trouble.
And I think if you just simply, I think it was Catherine Austin Fitz said that she was looking at what people spend a year on carbonated sodas.
Yeah.
And what they spend on fresh vegetables. And they said, I think it was like $2 billion a year on fresh vegetables and $10 billion on carbonated soda. So if you just reverse that, you could solve most people's health problems, the chronic
absolutely illness. Absolutely. And you know, I am pretty perky and healthy for someone my age. It's becoming clearer and clearer as I get older that I'm benefiting from a chemical free diet. And I will say that there's two promising things. I always want to bring up promising things just for the optimists out there that want to hear such things. But one is that in our local Costco, there's been a rebellion, and about 40% of the food items are now organic and labeled as such. Mm-hmm. Because that was just a rebellion from the marketplace. The people just, they would put, like 10 years ago, we were complaining there was nothing organic, and they put out one little product out of 1,000, and that one would sell 10 to 1. Then they would put out another. Now, you go to the counter, which used to be nothing but You know, the toxic chicken, you know, the stuff with the hormones and the insect, you know, all of the antibiotics and steroids. You can't even find them now. It's just organic chicken, the whole case, right? That's all the eggs now, the largest fraction are organic eggs. And they're a little bit more expensive, but no one cares. People are catching on. So that's one really important revolution that's going on. And that's just an information exchange where the population is wising up and the behavior is changing. This is great. This is what can happen politically.
Yeah.
We see it with food. And the other one is the electric car, which is becoming very, very popular here in Santa Barbara. We're sort of a trendsetter in this regard. And the reason that the electric car is cool is because you can have solar panels, like I do, and you're off the system. You're out of the – see, the oil system is set up. Maybe we should do a show on this sometime. But, you know, you can actually trace the families back to the East-West Trading Company that set up the oil company, right? Well – these are the same guys that actually sold slaves. I mean, this is talking about a slave system. I mean, this is what they were selling, and then of course they were creating the opium addiction in China, which was a completely Masonic process with Lord Palmerston being the head of the gunships that went down the Yangtze to blow up the Chinese that were rebelling, and he was also the chief Freemason, some kind of like potentate, some kind of bizarre title, but he was leading both groups when he went to blow up the Chinese. So the fact that, you know, you can now have a car that you have transportation and you're not in that slave system is wonderful. So those are two little points of light, to use an expression, Tim, that have come into existence, and hopefully there'll be more in the future.
You just have to beat back the self-driving car.
Yeah, because the whole purpose of that is to have complete control over, you know, where we are at all times. We won't even be able to drive where we're going. Yeah, but self, and it's associated with the electric car because Musk, you know, is promoting it. But you could have it for either gas.
Oh yeah, of course. Yeah, yeah.
So it's not really a, you know, so. Self-driving car has to be resisted, just like the cashless society, because these are just, you know, the icing on the cake of slavery, where the government can simply monitor everything at all times, you know. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and you have to, like, resist sort of this coerced urbanization that they're trying to do with
Well, I mean, once all wealth becomes like a Bitcoin, you know, that's just, it's an event in the internet that the government has the control over, right, because they can turn off the switch.
Mm-hmm.
Well, man, if they want to come back with violence and terror, they're not going to have a whole lot of trouble, will they? Because all of the what we regard as wealth now can just be turned off by a flip of a switch.
Yep. Yep. And if everyone's living above a Target in a little micro apartment.
Oh, God. Well, so. we're just not going to let it happen, Tim. We're going to organize ourselves. We're going to become more clear-minded, and we're going to change the effectiveness of our democracy to put into place people that will actually defend the people rather than just work to enslave them.
Yeah. Okay. Well, anything else tonight?
No, brother. That's a lump. And I thank you. I want to thank you for letting me, go into some of the analysis. I hope it wasn't.
I think there's a lot to chew on there, and I think.
But next week we'll be right back in the trenches, you know, with our normal stuff, but. Anyway, I hope that was of some use to the listeners.
And you, the book about the secret...
Secret Language of the Oligarchs.
When does that due out?
It's not... I mean, it's like whenever the author can get his head clear enough to finish it.
Okay.
It's one of these things where I, because I'm writing, like, basically kind of building upon Caesar's Messiah and Shakespeare's Secret Messiah... there's just no one really can do editing of it except me, and I'm illiterate, so it takes a long time to get these things done. And also because, you know, I'll tell you one thing. I know you, and you stimulate me, and then I have to put in the results of my thinking into the book. I don't want to, you know, it's like, I there's a half a dozen things, basically, which are just, you know, because you would point something out, and then I would start thinking and go, gee, I really need to put that in there. And so it's kind of grown, but then I also want to shrink it because it gets too long, and I want to make it readable But anyway, it'll be out shortly, and you'll be the first person to get a copy, and
Oh, great.
I'm forward to what you think of it.
Yeah, okay, great. Okay, well, I'll let you go, and
Thank you,
talk
Tim. Thank
again
you so
next week.
much. We'll get them next week, buddy.
Okay, good night then. Bye-bye.
Good night. Bye-bye. Thank you.